welcome to this episode of our podcast, Advokatene Forklare, or how we would translate it into English, Lawyers Explain. This is a special episode of this podcast where we talk about the changing regulatory landscape for M&A. My name is Carsten Greiling and I'm an M&A partner in Wirsholm.
And I'm Elizabeth Hugstall, a partner in Wirsholm's EU and competition team.
And in the beginning of December of last year, Wirsholm hosted the Nordic Buyout Forum, which is one of the biggest conferences in Norway for M&A practitioners. And this year we had the record participation of more than 500 participants. What we recognized very early on was that several speakers on this conference, very accomplished and established practitioners and academics, all took up particularly one topic, and that was the regulatory landscape for M&A, regulatory framework. And this is therefore a very, very up-to-date and very hot topic for M&A, not only in Norway, but internationally, all around the world. And it is developing very, very fast at the moment.
So if we look at the regulatory landscape for M&A, the main focus has previously been on traditional regulatory aspects such as competition law and merger control, and specifically, as well as other special filing requirements for regulated industries such as financial services, energy, and the pharma industry.
And recently, this regulatory landscape has been evolving due to particularly two seemingly contradictory drivers. On the one hand, we clearly have the globalization and digitalization of the world, which made it possible for investors to invest cross-border and enter new markets on a completely different scale than we have seen before. So investors can make investments to acquire new technologies that are probably not available in the same form in their home markets, and acquire expertise. And we have seen that this has happened in a very, very large scale in recent years.
On the other hand, there is also increasing political tensions and multiple crises, which has led to increased protectionism. While the macro environment has been relatively stable since the financial crisis in 2007-2008, we now see increased tensions between China and the West. We've had the COVID pandemic, multiple wars in both Ukraine and the Middle East, and all of this has led to an increase and a shift to protect domestic industries, and also on an increased tendency amongst regulators to control important input factors. An example of this is in the EU is, for example, the European Chips Act and the Chips for Europe initiative, and the Critical Raw Materials Act, both to protect goods and that are of high economic importance for Europe, while also recognizing that there are vulnerable supply disruptions in an increasingly complex world.
And these developments have clearly led to a shift of the regulators' attention to new areas. For example, sanctions, the FDI controls, so the control of foreign direct investments, and the control of state subsidies. And in the following, we are concentrating on two regulatory regimes which have significantly increased in importance for mergers and acquisitions. And that is the control of FDI and the new foreign subsidies regulation. Starting with FDI control, what is this really? This is the regulatory oversight of investments made from investors from third countries into businesses of national security interest, critical infrastructure, or otherwise of relevance for public order. Probably historically, the first and most prominent act that came into force was the CFIUS mechanism in the US. But we have recently seen that Europe is drastically catching up, with currently only a few EU EEA member states being without the national FDI law. Just in December, Sweden introduced a new law, for example. So there is a lot of development in this area. What is important to note on at this point is that this is a truly international question, which needs to be looked at globally, because M&A practitioners will have to deal with all sorts of rules in different countries, which are different and which every state, so far at least, to a very large extent, determines itself. What's in scope of these regulations? So we are normally looking at inbound investment from third countries. So, for example, investments from non-US companies into US businesses, from non-EU, non-EEA companies into EU EEA businesses. This first requirement for the rules to apply is usually and purposefully formalistic. So it usually covers purely formal corporate structures established, for example, in areas outside of the relevant geography, such as corporate fund structures, like you see a lot for private equity funds, for example. What you then need to acquire is some form of significant influence or control. And this trigger requirement is very, very complex and is different in almost all regulations that we deal with. So you're talking obviously about different ownership thresholds that you need to acquire, 10%, 25%, and so on. And this varies a lot. In addition, usually you can acquire control directly or also indirectly, and here you see that the real complications become obvious. So you have to calculate ownership thresholds based on quite difficult rules through large corporate structures. You can probably acquire control through other mechanisms, through veto rights in shareholders agreements and so on. So there are a lot of difficult questions that you need to assess. The business that you're investing in needs to be in the area of critical infrastructure or considered of national security interests. That may seem obvious what this is at first glance. So when you acquire a stake in a weapons producer or acquire an airport, many people would agree that this is obvious, that this falls under the regulations. But what we see in practice is that a lot more is covered than is obvious. For example, a lot of regulations will cover investments in tech companies, particularly now in companies dealing with AI. And these days, a lot of companies actually deal with AI more than you think. Or another example is investments in social media businesses, which often are caught by the regulations. What does this mean in conclusion? We see that a lot of minor cases and minor transactions actually trigger FDI requirements. It can go so far that some business, some place has an otherwise insignificant branch which just has one contract with a public body, and suddenly you are in a situation where you need to assess an FDI filing requirement. And what is important to note here is that usually these rules have no or a very, very low materiality threshold, so a financial materiality threshold, meaning that it doesn't matter that the business you are acquiring or the stake you are acquiring has a very, very low monetary value. You will still usually be caught by the rules. In addition, what we already said, there is little harmonization. You have different rules applying in different countries. When the rules are triggered, the tools that the regulators have can probably be summarized by the obvious ones. So they are assessing transactions. They have often the right to stop or demand that transactions are reversed. Very often you have voluntary and also mandatory filing requirements, often coupled with standstill obligations. And that is very, very important, because it means that when such a standstill obligation applies, a deal cannot close before the approval or a decision of the relevant regulator is actually rendered. Sometimes, and sometimes also a bit surprisingly, regulators have different tools. For example, in Norway, we see that parties are imposed with further restrictions on the business going forward after the transaction is completed. For example, when it comes to information sharing with the shareholders.
And in the EU Foreign Subsidies Regulation, or the FSR, has also recently entered into force. The FSR is the newest tool in the European Commission's toolbox to investigate foreign subsidies from third countries. And the background for this regulation is that there is an increasing worry amongst European regulators that state-led models of investment, particularly from China, and we also see that in the Middle East, have the potential to harm the European economy. In addition, as we mentioned, there has been an increasing appetite among Western countries to subsidize domestic industry. This has all been sparked by the COVID-19 pandemic downturn and the need to transition to a more green economy. A good example of this is the current subsidies race between the US and the EU, where the EU, through the FSR, is trying to counter some of the negative effects from the American Inflation Reduction Act, which, as many will be aware, includes tax reliefs for buying American products, for example. A key aim for the FSR in an M&A context is to enable the European Commission to investigate whether the acquiring party in a transaction was able to outbid other bidders because of foreign subsidies. And this has not been a problem within the EU because we have very stringent state aid rules, and which Norway also adheres to. But now the European Commission is seeking to extend this competence and also investigate subsidies from third countries outside the EU. It's important to note that the FSR really tries to capture the big transactions. And this is because the big transactions have the possibility to make the most damage to the internal market. As the president of the European Competition Commission has stated, the FSR aims to catch the big fish with the biggest teeth, which have the possibility to harm the European market and ultimately then European consumers. And in order to capture this, the FSR really operates with two thresholds. And these are decisive whether or not a filing was required under the regime. And the first is a turnover threshold. The turnover threshold relates to the target only. And there is a requirement that the target is established in the EU or has a local presence in the EU, for example, through a branch or another incorporation. And the target must generate a turnover in the EU of at least 500 million euros. While this may seem, you know, quite simplistic, it's important to note that the entire target universe has to be assessed for determining whether the turnover threshold is fulfilled. And this means, for example, that infrastructure companies and larger transport companies are likely to meet the threshold, even though a 500 million euro threshold is at the outset quite large.
The second criterion that needs to be fulfilled is that foreign financial contributions have been received of more than 50 million euros. We will talk about what this means, what foreign financial contributions actually are in a minute. But what is very important for this criterion is that we need to look at the target, but here also at the buyer universe. So we need to look in accordance with the purpose of this regulation, particularly also at the buyers, and see which financial contributions they have received. In order to calculate this and in order to determine which entities in the structure have to be included in this assessment, we need to look at the criterion which is very well known from antitrust regulations already, that is the control criterion, the control concept. And here, particularly important for private equity players, we need to go through the entire control structure, potentially all the way up to other controlled funds and all the way down again, and in order to also probably catch controlled portfolio companies. What this means is that in our view, in practice, it will be very, very likely that at least the large global players will always fulfill this second requirement, i.e. the threshold for financial for foreign financial contributions. So it will be decisive whether you stay under a filing obligation and under the threshold, whether also the first criterion that Elisabeth just described is fulfilled.
When looking closer at what constitutes a foreign financial contribution under the FSR, it's clear that basically every interaction that the buyer or target has with a governmental authority or a public entity or private entity entrusted with public tasks is caught. For example, one, you could look at loans, grants, exemptions from taxes or charges. These will naturally be caught and would also be caught under the stated rules. But we also have purchase and sale of goods and services, lease agreements and other property agreements, and other form of cost and or compensation coverage. These will all be caught as a foreign financial contribution, and the list really goes on and on. It's important to note that there is no requirement that goods or services are sold or purchased based on preferential rates. So this means that transactions that a buyer or a target has with a third country authority is caught even though it is on market terms. It's also completely immaterial if this contribution has a link to the transaction for the purposes of determining whether there is a filing obligation. And this means, as Carsten mentioned, that potentially the threshold is quite easy to fulfill. From a Norwegian perspective, you could envisage, for example, that energy tariffs to Statnett and revenue that derives from public procurement contracts, even though they are the result of a competition with state entities such as Bane NOR, Vy, and others, would also be caught as a foreign financial contribution. The same is true for, of course, COVID support. And also transactions involving, you know, sale of housing projects and land to the government. If the thresholds of turnover and foreign financial contributions are met, this will inevitably trigger a filing threshold under the FSR. And as Carsten mentioned in the introduction, under the FSR, there's also a standstill obligation, which means that you cannot close the transaction pending the outcome of the European Commission's investigation. The FSR has drawn inspiration from the merger control regime and also introduces fines for gun jumping. So it's important, of course, to be very diligent in examining whether the thresholds for filing are met and of notifying in a timely manner.
And when the filing requirement is triggered, as Elisabeth just has described, you will have to face very, very extensive consequences, particularly with respect to the information that needs to be provided in the notification. You will need to, in an M&A context, have to provide due diligence reports, financial valuations, including potentially the models that you're using for determining the purchase price, financial due diligence reports, and other descriptions of the transaction rationale. But it doesn't stop there. When the transaction is a result of an auction, you need to provide even more information. You need to describe the profile of other bidders, and provide information that is usually very, very, very sensitive to you. In addition, the competition has further powers to demand more information and can basically demand anything they want in order for them to make their decision. And that means that you will potentially be forced to deliver information that is at the core of each investor's proprietary and confidential information that you usually, for all purposes, try to keep confidential. And what will be very interesting and challenging to see in the future is how this will play out in practice, what actually will need to be provided, and what probably can be prevented from being provided through other legal possibilities that you may have under the FSR. But this will be a topic that we will have to look at closely when we see how the FSR is actually applied in practice.
What we can expect, of course, is that the European Commission is likely to closely scrutinize all foreign financial contributions which have to be listed in the notification form, and that is all contributions over 1 million euros, to see if they constitute a foreign subsidy. And that will be the case if they confer a benefit on the buyer or the target. This assessment is time-consuming, of course. And the timeline under the FSR really mirrors that of the EU merger regulation. So that means that the European Commission has 25 working days to assess the transaction in phase one and 90 working days to assess the transaction in phase two. And looking at, you know, the risk of any intervention from the EU, it's likely that those contributions that facilitate a deal are likely to cause most concern. And if the European Commission finds that the deal is problematic, they do have the power to intervene against the transaction, notably to prohibit it or make approval subject to commitments. This is also mirroring what we know from the merger control sphere.
Going back to M&A transactions in general, what do these regulatory requirements actually mean for practitioners, for people involved in M&A? Firstly, it's becomes very, very clear that these questions become more and more important. You will have more regulatory requirements, which means that more transactions will in one form or the other be caught by these regulatory requirements. So this will have to be a key assessment that basically everyone involved in a transaction has to make much, much more often. The best example is the FSR, which is a completely new tool which is introduced to mainly target M&A transactions. But also the FDI regimes are constantly extending. More countries implement rules and existing rules are tightened. Looking at Norway, the war in Ukraine has been an absolute game changer, and we see that also investments from Middle Eastern investors have received a lot of media attention in Norway, leading to quite a lot of political activity also in this area. We are expecting that an extended FDI regime will come into force in Norway now, very, very soon, in the beginning of 2024. And just before Christmas, an expert commission has delivered a report to the Norwegian government asking for an urgent and basically complete overhaul of the existing FDI regime in Norway. And when this is implemented in accordance somewhat with what is being demanded, then we will need to look at a probably completely new rule set, but which at the same time also then introduces a lot of the mechanisms that we are already known with from other EU member states, for example. Another development which we need to have a close look at going forward is that potentially also outbound investments will come into focus. So this goes a bit into the other direction. For example, the US have just introduced a rather limited regime, but still a regime that looks into investments of US companies outside US territory. And we hear rumors that the EU is also looking at something similar.
So what then are the key effects for M&A? Well, the first one is fairly obvious, that these new regulatory tools will decrease deal certainty. In a worst-case scenario, of course, a transaction can be blocked or made subject to remedies. In the FDI context, we see that the prohibition of the sale of Bergen engines to a Russian-led buyer was blocked. And while that's perhaps not the most likely scenario in every transaction, there is a possibility that this will happen. Under the FSR, the European Commission has a similar competence, but of course, given that this is quite a fairly new framework, we are not yet, it's not yet certain how the Commission will use this power.
In practice, probably the most relevant consequence for M&A transaction is the delay in transactions. So transactions take often a lot longer time than they did before, and that is particularly due to the standstill obligation that are introduced for more and more FDI regulations, and that also the FSR has included. In Norway, we are expecting a standstill obligation to be implemented for the FDI regime together with a new set of rules that we already mentioned in the beginning of 2024. But the standstill obligation, in a way, is then, or the consequences of the standstill obligation are then, in a way, multiplied by other factors. For FDI particularly, some jurisdictions still operate without clear deadlines for when the authorities have to make their decisions and do not regulate the consequences for the authorities not to do anything, which basically gives quite an unforeseeable time frame for the participants and a lot of leverage for the regulators. The regulations we are dealing with are often also relatively new and immature. So often we don't know what all these new legal concepts mean. Elisabeth just described the uncertainties around the definition of the financial contributions with respect to the FSR. So what we see in practice as a consequence is that careful bidders more often than not get trapped also for, in the end, completely unproblematic transactions in lengthy processes just because they are careful and just because they want to avoid the risk that the regulator actually creates.
And we also see that processes become more costly. Inevitably, as more regulatory tools are added to the regulator's toolbox, there is a need to conduct more risk assessments. And of course, there will be a need for more filings. This will, of course, ramp up the cost for advisors, but also for management in terms of time and the personnel that you have to use on these processes. We know that companies are, in terms of FSR, hiring dedicated FSR resources and setting up internal systems to track foreign financial contributions, which is quite a cumbersome task. And also to keep track of turnover thresholds, as one also does in a merger context. So we've spoken a lot about the challenges of these new regulatory tools under the FDI and FSR rules. But what then about the solutions? How can we navigate the increasing complexity brought about by these regulatory tools? The first one that we would highlight is, of course, that it's very important to be prepared at all times. So private equity and other large corporations, they need to implement systems which can track continuously turnover, governmental contracts which may be subject to FDI filings, and also any contributions received that are notifiable under the FSR. And the FSR really brings this to a new level with the difficulty in implementing or the difficulty in calculating the foreign financial contributions under the regulation. The second one is to think of regulatory challenges from day one and implement and calculate this when calculating the deal timeline. For the sell side, it's important to be able to conduct an early assessment of whether the turnover threshold may be met for the target to be spun off, and also whether a filing may be likely based on the foreign financial contribution that the target has received. This can also be a risk mitigating factor in terms of, you know, when looking at the buyer universe, which This can also be a risk mitigating factor when looking at which buyers are potentially relevant for the transaction in order to, for example, avoid the lengthy process that Carsten was just mentioning and secure kind of a swift deal transaction.
The third key takeaway is that we are recommending all parties to consider to strengthen regulatory due diligence. That is a rather obvious point. Of course, on the buy side, you don't want to be caught in a situation where you find out after having signed the deal that the deal actually was subject to an FDA filing requirement. But it doesn't start there. It may even in future, due to the increasing number of regulatory requirements and obstacles that you have to deal with, be relevant to engage in these assessments very, very early on in order to probably even at an earlier point make decisions about whether it at all makes sense to go about and start other probably costly due diligence processes, for example, in a transaction that in the end may not have any viable future. What this means for the sell side is that these assessments that the buy side obviously needs to do need to be anticipated. So the sell side needs to prepare for this process, needs to provide all the information that the buyer needs for making these assessments, which in itself can be very, very time-consuming and cumbersome processes. Another key takeaway from our side is that these challenges that we have shown can create the opportunities for using those as a competitive factor in a process, somewhat as a flip side to what we have said. The sell side will, particularly in auction processes, consider the regulatory risk attached to each individual bid individually and potentially weigh it quite high as one of the decisive factors for choosing a bidder. Again, buyers should anticipate this and they may increase their chances of their bid being chosen by anticipating these assessments that the sell side will make and make their own assessments, provide sound and comprehensive regulatory risk assessments and for identified risks, probably provide solutions how they can be mitigated so that their bid in the end comes through. Importantly, and as a last point we wanted to mention, is that all these factors will heavily influence deal terms and structures. And there are multiple ways where this will hit the transaction documents. One being conditions, obviously, you will need to assess which conditions the deal needs to be subject to in order to comply with the different regulatory requirements. And you will increasingly have to look at each of these requirements individually and draft specific conditions for each of these requirements, as they all have different prerequisites and consequences attached to them. Another point that will probably be more often discussed and regulated is who takes what risk for what outcome of which regulatory filing. We may see an increase in the discussion around break fees or other forms of financial compensation for a deal being made subject to the conditions or being stopped eventually. One of the key effects of these rules that we have already mentioned is that the timing will definitely increase. You will have longer time frames and will have to deal with a lot of uncertainty, and this will hit in multiple areas. Usually, the sell side is after the signing of a deal under obligation to run the target's business in the ordinary course. And when you're looking at the time frame of 3, 6 or even more months or even years, and when you particularly look at a situation where you have no clue in the beginning how long this will actually take, it is obvious that parties to an increasing extent need to discuss and regulate flexibility for unforeseen circumstances that happen in this long time frame. if you just think back what in terms of macro events has happened in the last years and what businesses needed to cope with at very, very short notice, that makes this obvious. You will, for example, have to regulate CapEx spending over a much longer time. You will have to discuss which CapEx spending needs to be made and which CapEx spending is allowed to be made under the transaction documents. The purchase price mechanisms will probably also be affected. You should think twice before you agree on a high lockbox interest rate when suddenly the deal, instead of the expected 1 month, takes 12 months until closing. And this may even lead to an increased use of closing accounts, particularly to be able to take these developments between signing and closing in consideration also when it comes to the purchase price. Lastly, we may even see more creative closing structures. We may see the increased use of carve-outs of problematic parts of the transaction perimeter, so of the parts that are subject to regulatory requirements. Or we may see structures where you close in installments, meaning that you close certain parts of the deal that are not affected, not infected, so to say, by the regulatory requirements before the other parts and deal with the rest later. But this is obviously something that requires a deal of a certain size and a certain complexity. Looking back, we hope we haven't destroyed your mood after listening to this podcast with just showing all sorts of challenges and problems that you are facing in dealing with M&A transactions under these in light of these new requirements. What is important from our perspective is that we wanted to, by presenting these few snapshots of what you're looking at, we wanted to increase your awareness and at the same time show you that there are deals, there are ways to handle these challenges in deals, and hopefully give you some ideas in how you can get successful through these challenges. Thank you very much.
Thank you.